couple nights ago, I had a dream about Rifkin, and I forget exactly what the dream was. I just know that he, or at least the milieu of Rifkin's festival, was in my dream. You know, it's not the first time that Woody Allen or a Woody Allen related thing has popped up in my dreams over the past. How long has it been since the Dylan Farrell letter? 6 years, I think. Woody Allen has been a regular presence in my subconscious. And I think every time he's got a new movie out or anytime he pops up in the news again, I fall down again like a well of obsession. And I'm like, oh, man, I'm gonna read the court ruling again. Or yeah.
I mean, you wrote a magnum opus on Crisis in Six Scenes, which, like, I think you and the people that worked on the movie were probably the only people that watched it.
Well, when Crisis in Six Scenes came out, it was so funny because, like, it came out at the moment of peak TV. There was discourse around every prestige TV show, and, like, Crisis in Six Scenes got nothing. Not even outrage. It didn't even get, like, the hate clicks. It just totally ignored. Except for me. I watched all of it.
He should have released it now. It would have gone totally viral.
But, you know, it's funny. When Dylan Farrow wrote that open letter, I actually felt that my interest in Woody Allen was kind of at a low ebb. I kind of felt like I was over him a little bit.
I remember. We were talking about this the other day. There was a memory that I had from, like, probably, yeah, 2013, 2014, something like that, where we were with a friend of mine at my old place, and the two of us were saying, we're trying to think of a movie to watch. Two of us were saying, well, we could watch a Woody Allen film, and you were not into it. You were like, I don't know, he's got like five ideas, you know. You're like, well, we could maybe do Deconstructing Harry. I think that's the only one I want to watch. And so we watched Deconstructing Harry, but you were not super zealous about that, I remember.
And I feel like that has changed somewhat, even as he's become a more toxic presence. And I'm trying to figure out why it is, and I think some of it has to do with if you're a bespectacled kind of nebbishy kid and you grew up fantasizing about the adult world through the films of Woody Allen and projecting yourselves onto it. It's like when that suddenly becomes so deeply problematized, it's as if your father has become deeply problematized, you know?
I feel I've got some stuff I want to talk about before we get to the meat of today's show, but... You know, I already had a feeling based on what we watched that this was going to be an episode where we gained, you know, deep and possibly uncomfortable insight into the brain of Will Sloan.
We're going to be talking about my two dads, Woody Allen and John Waters.
And Will is coming out like fucking Al Pacino in Scarface. Just say hello to my little friend. Guns blazing. but like, what the hell is Rifkin's Festival? Because for... You know, our listeners who aren't checking your Twitter every 2 hours when you do a Rifkin's Festival tweet, like, what the hell are you talking about? I confess I had not heard about this movie until you tweeted about it.
Rifkin's Festival is Woody Allen's new movie. It played in Spain last fall. I'm sure it will be distributed elsewhere, but there's a file going around amongst the true Woodheads. And it's the first one that he's made since the bottom really fell out on his career. So it's got this really bizarre cast. It's about a filmmaker turned novelist, you know, an intellectual, a real Woody Allen type, played by Wallace Shawn.
I mean, there's almost always one, isn't there?
And like one of his flaws as a writer-director, I think, is an inability to kind of imagine outside his own subjectivity.
That's true, although a couple of his best films don't have him in it and don't have that character. The point is well taken, but I mean... If you think about a movie like Interiors, there's not really a Woody Allen character in that, or Another Woman.
Or, you know, the character of Annie Hall is a great character who's inspired by him trying to think through Diane Keaton's perspective. So, yes, he was once able to stretch himself artistically.
Not anymore.
Not anymore, because... So, Wallace Shawn is married to Gina Gershon, and she is a movie publicist, and they are at the San Sebastian Film Festival, which, by the way, put up a significant amount of money for this venture. And there is a filmmaker played by Louis Garrel from The Dreamers. He's a young hotshot filmmaker. He's a politically conscious filmmaker. And Wallace Shawn has no patience for this. It's like, politics. What is politics? I mean, that's just ephemeral. Why aren't filmmakers today tackling the big questions? Like, what's it all about? Is there a God? You know, the questions posed by the great masters like Bergman. And the movie is a little bit like Midnight in Paris, because it'll lapse periodically into dream sequences when he dreams himself into these Criterion Closet movies, you know? And the most recent one is Jules and Jim. No, wait, the most recent one is 8 and a half. So, you know, his taste has obviously, like, I mean, I don't want to begrudge him too much for it, because obviously those are the movies that mean something to him.
I've always thought of Fellini as essentially a technical director. Granted, La Strada was a great film, great in its use of negative imagery more than anything else.
So, I mean, it's wonderful that the Woodman still loves those movies and everything, but the problem is...
Well, the thing is, I like those movies, but, like, I encountered them, like, in the last, like, 10 years, right? Like, yeah. Think about how long it's been since he first encountered them.
Well, I just think, really, there's been nothing in 60 years that, like, excited you at all? You didn't see any Wong Kar-wai along the way? Like, there was no other art house filmmaker? I'm psychoanalyzing him through this movie, and the Louis Garrel character, I think, is symbolic of the world that has rejected him in recent years. You know, Woody knows he's out of fashion, and he sees Louis Garrel, who is a political filmmaker. And the Louis Garrel filmmaker, he says at one point that his new movie, he hopes that it will reconcile the Arabs and Israel. And we hear nothing else about the plot of the movie except that that's what it is. So that's hilarious, because it's like, okay, first of all, what filmmaker is making a movie right now where he hopes it will reconcile the Arabs and Israel? Nobody's touching that topic. No film festival is programming that movie. It's just Woody is sitting at his typewriter and he's like, what's a political issue? Israel. And he puts that down. And at one point, Louis Garrel says something like, oh, I'm really inspired by the old American masters like Hawks and John Ford and Frank Capra. And Wallace Shawn is like, yeah, they're wonderful, but they were optimistic. They lied about life, not like Bergman and Fellini, etc. And it's like, okay, this straw man filmmaker that Louis Garrel plays, who is this? Is there anyone alive who resembles this at all? He wants to solve the Arab-Israeli conflict, and he is inspired by Howard Hawks. That's his chief creative touchstone. What's really funny about it is, you know, Woody Allen is looking out at this world that he hasn't even really bothered to look out at. And he's like, fuck this world. I'm the one who's right. Society is wrong. Whatever these movies are that I haven't seen and aren't engaging with that I think are political in some way, I don't need to see them because I know what's right. And he responds by producing his laziest movie ever, a movie where it's just the same questions asked listlessly, and it ends with Christoph Waltz as Death in a Seventh Seal parody.
Really?
Yeah.
He's already played that before. I mean, that's like
he's played half a dozen times.
Love and Death, Deconstructing Harry has that, I think. Like,
yeah, there are other ones too, but yeah, Christoph Waltz at the end, he's playing chess with Wallace Shawn, and he's like, well, just because life is meaningless doesn't mean it has to be empty. There are many ways you can fill it with work, with family, enjoy life, even though
Louis Armstrong, Potato Head Blues.
Yes. The first movement of the Jupiter Symphony, Marlon Brando, Groucho Marx, yeah. Tracy's face. Oh, man. Anyway, Christoph Waltz is saying this, and I'm like, I can't believe it. This is the exact same epiphany that he had at the end of Hannah and Her Sisters. And it's 30 years. It might be, is it 40 years later? Almost.
It's almost 40 years later.
And we're still getting the epiphany, but with even less force. There's a lot that's been going through my head about this movie this week, partly my own complicated relationship with the man himself, partly also just like being aghast and like kind of amused that a movie like this can exist, you know, is running on fumes, that is like a photocopy of a photocopy from something that, you know, was maybe once seemed like maybe a little shallow 30 years ago.
All of the stuff in his personal life aside, I mean, I feel like the best case scenario for any director that's no longer making sort of like, that's no longer rolling out a movie every year that's like a huge commercial success, best case scenario is do these kind of like labors of love, like less expensive, you know, cheaper to make, maybe like only for the real heads, like, I don't know, like quite artistic and experimental. That's the best case scenario. Like the worst case scenario is just to fade away doing these kind of like, like copy of a copy of a copy, like you said. The best case scenario for a filmmaker is to do what like a lot of the jazz giants of like the 50s and 60s did, which is like by the 70s and 80s, they're just playing like, you know, this fusion music that is like so crazy and dissonant and weird that like only nerds can appreciate it. You know, it's like Stellar Visions is not, or whatever it was called, is not as accessible as like A Love Supreme, but at least it's like still art. At least it's interesting. Why can't Woody make bitches brew is what I'm saying.
I think I have the answer, and I'm psychoanalyzing him further. I think the events of 1992 with Sunyi Previn and Dylan Farrow and Mia Farrow, that whole scandal traumatized him on some level to the point where he was like, you know, he was so roundly condemned. And at some point he was like, you know what? I'm right and the world is wrong and I refuse to grow. I refuse to self-examine.
I'm beyond good and evil.
Yeah. And I think after that, you didn't see movies like Husbands and Wives anymore. You didn't see movies like Hannah and Her Sisters. You saw a lot more movies about how the heart wants what it wants and how relationships are irrational and you have to take whatever happiness you can take because the world is meaningless.
Life is fatalistic. Like sometimes the tennis ball falls on one side of the net. Sometimes it falls on the other. You hope it falls on the side that benefits you. Maybe it does. Maybe it doesn't. You know, maybe you kill your mistress and get away with it, or, you know, so
or
that
you
do can
some
marry
other crime perhaps and get away with it. Who knows?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. Of course, a lot of people would take you to task for even thinking about this at all. They would say, why are you centering Woody in all this? What would your response to that be?
You know, my response to that would be like, fair enough. You know, some people would say, some people would say, why are we talking about this ancient man who may be a sex criminal when we could be spotlighting other topics and voices?
When we could be fighting world hunger.
Or solving the Israel-Palestine crisis, as Louis Garrel heroically tries to do in Rifkin's Festival. And my response to that would be, you know, the heart wants what it wants.
Well, I mean, I think, I feel like you, like, every time I see you tweet about one of these movies that no one sees, like, you know, like Rifkin's Festival or Crisis in Six Scenes, it seems like part of the bit is that you know this is completely ridiculous. It's a total waste of time. It's just like a silly obsession. And I mean, it's very funny to me when you do this.
That is definitely part of the bit, but also it is compulsive. Like, there's something eating away at me inside that I have to express.
There was a period in 2014, you know, after the open letter, where you were just like, for several months, you were sending me like every think piece
I'm
written
sorry,
about it.
Yeah.
And we're just like dissecting them like in such detail. And yeah. Sometimes I wouldn't even respond, and then there'd just be like another one, and you'd write like several paragraphs about it.
Yes. Yes, I do remember that period, actually.
Later turned into the popular Tumblr account, Texts from Will Sloan.
Anyway, welcome to Michael and Us. I'm Will Sloan.
Welcome to the show, everybody. This is one of those times we're recording on a weekend. Will's got a cup of coffee. I just drank a Red Bull. We're feeling good. It's actually a long weekend
in Ontario.
Well, but here's the thing. On Monday, my American colleagues will celebrate President's Day, typically reactionary American holiday. Here in Ontario, however, we'll be celebrating Family Day. The long-standing and hallowed tradition of Family Day, which, as far as I can tell, was created, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago, partly because of lobbying by breweries, because there was no long weekend in February, and so the Liberal government, Liberal provincial government under Premier Dalton McGuinty was like, we'll call it Family Day, I guess. Family's a thing people like, right?
And I'm all for it, you know? I think it's great. I love having one more long weekend in the year. I mean, I'm sad that I can't see my family to do all of our Family Day rituals.
Yeah, I feel like we might sort of all, you know, go out, get some friends together, go out for dinner or something. There's all kinds of stuff we could do. Can't do that, but I'm nevertheless grateful to have the time off. I actually was writing, I've been writing this long review of Pete Buttigieg's memoir, which still isn't quite done. I got a couple other paragraphs to write, but
is this a post-campaign memoir?
Yeah, so it came out after his primary campaign, but like just ahead of November's election, and before his appointment to the august post of Secretary of Transport. He's actually changed his handle to Secretary Pete. And he actually has the, he's like, in his bio, it says something about how he's like, you know, it's like 19th United States Secretary of Transport, which it's like, okay, buddy, I don't think anybody cares.
Did you see what Amy Klobuchar tweeted when he got that post? She said something like, congratulations for becoming transportation secretary. Your local government experience will help you in the position.
Yeah, that's great. But yeah, so I was writing, I mean, it's a lot of time to spend with Pete Buttigieg. I mean, like, the book is, his book is like barely 200 pages, I think. And like, this review will probably be, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 words. So I don't know what percentage of, like, I don't know what Pete's word count is, but it might be like 5% as long as the book or something, or maybe even more than that. There's so much padding in this book. Like, I'm going to quote in the review, like, there's this long passage where he's just meticulously describing what it sounds like when a modem connects to the internet. Like, he describes every stage of what it looks and sounds like. And as far as I can tell, this exists for no other reason. You know, he obviously spins it into like some bullshit tangent about like, oh, the ups and downs of living in an increasingly interconnected world. It's like, on the one hand, information has been democratized and dictatorships have a harder time lying. On the other, people are spreading fake news. But it's like, let's be real. This passage exists, one, to pad his word count, because he had a deadline to meet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's a busy man. He wasn't working at the time. He was doing a podcast. And, you know, as you and I know, that can be very time consuming. So, you know, he found time in his busy schedule to write like a 30,000 word book or whatever. And, you know, reason number two, I think the real reason for this passage is because Pete wants us to know that he is a bona fide millennial. A lot of people don't know that.
How old is he?
39, something like that.
Okay.
He's born in 82. He's like an older millennial.
Borderline, yeah. Okay.
I mean, let me tell you, it did not help him with the youth in the election. He had absolutely terrible numbers with millennials and Zoomers. They were put off by his like authoritarian milk monitor brandishing his hall pass energy that he carries around with him. But yeah, I mean, people didn't know he was a millennial. They definitely didn't read that in like any of the 2000 fluffy profiles that were written about him and his socks and his music tastes and the fact that he knows like 7 phrases of Norwegian or whatever. Anyway, I started this by saying, oh, I'm taking a break from all that. But then here we are like talking about it on the podcast. Would like to put that behind us for now. There were a couple things I wanted to talk about off the top before we got into the movie. I feel like we would be remiss not to talk a little bit about the political news today, which was something that I became aware of because I looked at Twitter right before I started the movie, and there were a bunch of people like tagging me being like, oh, this thing that's happening with the impeachment trial like validates, you know, something Luke Savage has been saying. And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. I've been mostly ignoring the impeachment trial. I guess I should look into this. So I want to read a bit for context here from something by Jack Merkinson at the Discourse blog, Democrats Gonna Democrat. This is an update on what just happened a few hours ago in the impeachment trial. He writes, today, Democrats did just about the most Democrat thing you can possibly imagine. Just as Donald Trump's impeachment trial was wrapping up, Rep. Jamie Raskin, the lead Democratic impeachment manager, dramatically announced that he wanted to call Republican Jamie Herrera Butler as a witness. Butler had issued a damning statement about Trump's discussions with House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy in the wake of the Capitol attack, blah, 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 and Democrats apparently wanted to hear about it. The full Senate then voted to allow witnesses in the trial, something that instantly raises the stakes of the proceedings and opened the possibility of a longer, more intense, and potentially more incriminating case against Trump. So this was like basically, this was a dramatic raising of the stakes on the trial. And earlier today, so as Jack writes, you know, Republicans got mad at this. They didn't want people to have to testify under oath. So he writes, the stage was all set for Democrats to do something big. And then the Democrats decided, whoops, never mind. And this is where things stand. Democrats poked their heads above the line and then they remembered a few things. They remembered that they don't like it when Republicans get mad at them. They remembered that extending the trial would be time consuming and annoying and might cut in other vital business like going on vacation next week and figuring out ways to weaken their COVID relief plans. They remembered that at the end of the day, they favor grubby little backroom deals that keep the Senate, the system, chugging along rather than bold moves that would actually change anything. You know, so he concludes, of course, by raising the prospect of doing something bigger than backing down within the space of an hour or so, Democrats threw that strategy out the window. They came up with a new plan, got excited about it, then caved on their own idea. The story will now be about a party that, as it so often did during the Trump years, flirted with a deeper level of accountability and decided that it would prefer a quiet life instead. Would Republicans have ever given Democrats the courtesy, the protection that Democrats just extended to them? You already know the answer to that question. So I don't know. This is pretty interesting. I mean, I don't actually really care about the impeachment trial. I mean, I think I buy that Trump did incite this riot, whatever we want to call it, the events of January the 6th. But I don't trust these institutions to hold anyone accountable for this. I never thought, except, I don't know, maybe for like a few hours on January the 7th, that anything big was gonna come out of this. Although I think I obviously buy into the idea of holding Donald Trump accountable for all kinds of things, like far more things than, you know, Democrats would ever be willing to do. I mean, one of the problems with holding Trump too accountable is that you'd have to hold other presidents accountable for various things. That's not something they want to do. But what I think is really interesting about, you know, this little episode that I just recounted that transpired earlier today is, you know, we've been talking in recent episodes about these kind of two competing contradictory impulses in the early Biden era. And I think this is a perfect manifestation of both of those impulses. So on the one hand, you have this trial, which, you know, is being framed by a lot of, you know, even kind of mainstream Democrats as like, we got to hold the bastards accountable. These people want to do fascism. If we don't prosecute them now, like, Donald Trump's going to run again. We have to make sure this never happens again. You know, we have to exact accountability and even, you know, kind of retribution for the depredations of the Trump era. That's impulse number one. Impulse number two is like, everything needs to go back to normal. You know, I'm not hearing about Donald Trump. I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to hear about the holes in Biden's executive orders. I don't want to hear that his ban on something Trump did or his like reversal of it is actually just a moratorium. I don't want any of that. Make it all go away. And so the spin on this is absolutely incredible. The spin that's coming from like David Axelrod, various other like Dem hacks online is, you know, it's good that the trial is being put to bed because we need to focus on more important things like COVID relief. Like only, you know, the implication is like only elites and like people in the bubble care about this. You know, as this is what elites and people in the bubble are saying, which is people very, you know, hastily pointed out. I mean, first of all, that's not how these people were framing this like yesterday, right? Or like a week ago. At various points, this trial has been the most important thing ever. And, you know, in some cases, people were framing it this way like hours before this flip flop. But secondly, if that's the case, why did they have the trial at all? I mean, they're essentially, having set up the trial, are making the case against it. I mean, it is, on a surface level, is like an incredible cell phone. I mean, I think on a deeper level, it certainly is a cell phone. But on a deeper level, I think it is just an expression of this contradiction that I feel like is going to play out in one way or another throughout the next few years, because so much of the sort of elan, like the only time Democrats can really summon any kind of zeal. I mean, it's hard to summon zeal when you don't really have a legislative agenda that's clear and that you're passionate about. They don't want to start a fight with special interests or corporations or anything like that. All political storytelling, every political narrative needs a foe. So, you know, we've talked before about how that foe, they're kind of setting it up. The foe is going to be right-wing extremism. You know, until recently, it's been Trump. So that, you know, that's all there. But then on the other hand, like the whole Biden mandate is premised on like making all of this go away, doing bipartisanship, right? Respecting the norms, turning down all the dials have been turned up to 11. We're going to turn them down to 1. We're going to keep turning them counterclockwise until they break off, so the device can never be turned on again. Like, that's the other strong impulse. And I feel like those impulses clash together like two great symbols in this impeachment trial. And this is the result, which is just the Democrats like dropping a banana peel for Trump's lawyers and Republican senators to slip on, and then like instantly forgetting they did so and slipping on it themselves and falling flat on their faces. So dumb. Democrat's gonna Democrat.
Well, I'm happy about it. I hope Trump runs again. I love having him around. Except when he's being racist, obviously.
It's okay. We're not in the Trump era anymore. This is the one like privilege of the Biden era, is that you don't have to couch everything. You don't have to qualify everything, but like, it can be axiomatic that you think Donald Trump's bad. You don't have to be like, oh, but of course Trump's bad. It's like, I think we've established.
Well, okay, that. Yeah. He's obviously no worse than any other Republican, and he's a lot funnier than all of them. So if we're going to have a Republican Party, of course I want him there doing jokes and causing laugh 'em ups. Anyway, somebody please take that audio and use it out of context.
My brother was building a security apparatus to keep us safe, and I'm proud of what he did. And he's had the gall to go after
the World
my
Trade
mother.
Center came
he's
down
had the gall
your brother's
to go after
reign.
My
Remember
mother.
That.
Hold on.
Let me finish this.
There was one other thing I wanted to add here, which is, you know, something I forgot to get in on a recent episode where we were talking about the article I wrote for The Atlantic about Prop 22. And I was explaining, you know, the various reasons why I write so much about liberals, which is something I feel the need to justify sometimes, because I feel like it's something that I guess readers on the left don't have trouble understanding this. But anytime, you know, anything I write gets significant engagement from people who, you know, might be of more kind of centrist inclinations or just kind of more liberal ones, they really don't get it. Even when they, to some extent, accept the substance of the criticisms or like could be receptive to them, sometimes they're just like, why are you doing this instead of holding Republicans accountable? Someone actually tweeted at me, who I think maybe a listener, in fact, recently, something to the effect of, you know, like, Luke raises a good point. Like, how do we hold Republicans accountable while, you know, also holding liberals accountable or something like that. And I'm not beating up on this person at all. It's not a criticism of them. The point was well taken, and it's a good question. But it did make me think about this idea of accountability. And I think this is something further I want to add on my list of why I write about liberals. Republicans don't. You can't hold them accountable, okay? Like, if you're like me or Will, or probably this applies to many of you listening to the show, you probably don't know that many people, if you know any people at all, or conservatives. And I can guarantee you that you don't know any, like, Republican elites. Like, you're not hanging out with Josh Hawley or whatever, you know? And furthermore, like, the media that you consume, the stuff that is holding Republicans accountable, is not consumed by Republicans. It's consumed by liberals. I'm not saying we should do away with the idea of like absolutely investigate the Koch brothers, investigate the Republican Party, report on what's going on. Just understand that that's an investigative process. It's about compiling information. It's about informing you. There's no dimension of accountability there. It might inform activism or something that you use to fight against the right, that fight against conservatism, fight against something like the Republican Party, fight against Donald Trump, but it's not holding them accountable. There's no Maude who is seeing like an article in the Huffington Post or Mother Jones or something that's reporting on the latest like Republican or Donald Trump deprivation. There's no Maude that sees that and is like, okay, this time he's gone too far. Something must be done. And, you know, throughout the Trump era, I think one of the things that irked me so much about the constant liberal obsession with him, like just people tweeting like 1,000 times a day, like about, you know, Donald Trump Jr. met, you know, Sergei
Eisenstein.
Yeah, right. Sergei Eisenstein, you know, in Belarus, and it's only 1 p.m., you know, like whatever, that kind of stuff is like, you can say all this stuff, you can shout all this stuff all you want, but there's no overriding, there's no authority that stands atop all this that's like capable of really holding this to account. I mean, the authorities that might hold any of this to account, those come in the form of like the Democratic Party and things like that. And as we've just seen, they're not really willing to do it most of the time. The article of mine that people were tweeting out again today was the one, why liberals pretend they have no power, because this seems like such a good case in point for the contradiction that I was observing, which is, you know, on the one hand, you have, you know, Nancy Pelosi saying Donald Trump is behaving like a dictator, this isn't North Korea, whatever. And then she's like, you know, voting to approve his military budgets or whatever. Mm. They're giving him new spy powers. Just to quickly bring things back to the idea of accountability here. I don't feel like I'm in a position to hold people on the right, particularly like Republican members of Congress, accountable for anything. But who I do have some minor power to exercise, you know, accountability over is liberals, right? For one thing, I'm a lot likelier to know people who are broadly might identify as liberals, who might be sympathetic to elite liberal figures. And so when those figures don't live up to their own rhetoric or something like that, I actually do think it's useful for me to intervene and say, well, look, they said this and then they did this. How can you say Donald Trump is, you know, how can you compare him to Kim Jong-un or something and then be like, oh, and we're gonna just, you know, expand the security state that's under his purview or whatever. I actually think stuff like that does serve a purpose. You can't hold a figure like Marjorie Taylor Greene accountable, you know? Or if you can, you certainly can't do it by posting. But when you call somebody who's an extremist, and you point out just the views that they are on record publicly expressing, like, that's not an insult to them. They don't care about your sense of propriety or whatever. So, I don't know. Am I making sense to you?
Well, I'm going to hold Nikki Haley to account for distancing herself from God Trump this week by flying to Iowa in 4 years and voting against her on the first ballot, which I obviously can do.
That, by the way, that just reminded me of, this is not related to what we're talking about, really. but that time where who's the white supremacist Republican congressman that he like lost a primary to just like some other reactionary, and then Alyssa Milano quote tweeted it and she was like, this is what we do to fascists in America, we vote them out of office. Yeah. And it's like, you voted in a Republican primary, like, yeah. Anyway, does that make sense? Am I actually like overcompensating to justify why, you know, my ratio of Jacobin articles about liberals to conservatives is probably like 4-1?
Well, I mean, we often talk about how the Overton window, quote unquote, has gone drastically to the right over the last 40 years. And the reason for that hasn't just been the right wing. It's been the left or the liberal side's capitulation to the right. I mean, that's the first boss that you have to go through to get to the big boss.
That is a much cruder and in many ways much better way of making the point that I just did.
Well, you know, I'm not an intellectual. I'm the guy at the barbershop who's been there for many years. And, you know, he may not have done any fancy book learning. He may not have read any Norman Chomsky, but he knows what's right. I'll tell you somebody who was held to account. Don Davenport, the sinister lead character of John Waters' 1974 film Female Trouble, who espoused the toxic philosophy that crime is beauty. And this film and its maker is the subject of discussion for this week.
Look, the star of Pink Flamingos is here again. It's Divine. She's got balls, and she's got female trouble.
I'm a thief and a shit kicker, and I'd like to be famous.
Dawn Davenport is eating a meatball sandwich right out in class.
Here she is, Divine as Dawn Davenport, a feisty young high school girl.
My parents are going to be real sorry if I don't get them cha-cha heels.
Nice girls don't wear cha-cha heels.
Those types, I'll never wear those ugly shoes. I told you not to.
Yes, she had a lot of problems. And she found herself in big female trouble.
Well, I just wanted to tell you that I'm pregnant and I want money. Baby, just because you got them big udders don't mean you're something special.
It's hard being a loving mother. I give her free food, a bed, clean underpants. What does she expect?
Look in the mirror, Taffy. For 14, you don't look so good.
So earlier this week, we did an episode on Tony Benn, which is obviously a very Luke-heavy subject. And after we finished recording, Will said, I'd like to do an episode on my Tony Benn, one Mr. John Waters, by which he meant, you know, somebody whose work is formative and important to him. So I feel like on this episode, we've already gotten a deep insight into the way Will Sloan sees the world. And I feel like we're about to journey into perhaps some even darker recesses of his psyche through discussion of a film which truly takes a hacksaw to propriety, a film that I was very mistaken to try to cook and eat breakfast while watching. I think like last week, you know, I have some things I might say about a film like this, but I think as Will did earlier this week, you know, I think I'm going to kind of take a back seat here. I want to quiz him. I want to ask him about this film. I want to ask him about the wider sensibilities of his that it's informed. I think I also want to caution people against watching this film unless you truly know what you're in for, because folks, it's pretty gross. You know, it's funny. I feel like we've watched a lot of like pretty transgressive stuff on this show, but I think this is the most transgressive thing we've actually ever watched.
More than Sallow, you would say?
I think this is more transgressive than Sallow, actually.
Well, that word transgressive is kind of how John Waters made his name. The movie that he made right before this that turned him into a kind of midnight sensation was Pink Flamingos. And that was a movie that ended with the iconic image of Divine, that's the name of his regular actor, a drag queen.
Pretty famous drag queen, in fact.
Quite famous. It ended with a scene of Divine eating dog dew straight from the source. Now, John Waters grew up in Baltimore, not connected to the entertainment industry in any way, but there was a burgeoning circuit of midnight movies going on at the time. Movies like El Topo, Night of the Living Dead, later on Eraserhead, films that would play at midnight all over the country. And he said, well, I want to get into that circuit and I got to do something to really make myself known. And I got to put something on screen that's not illegal and also that nobody's ever done before and that nobody would ever forget. And that was the image of a drag queen eating dog shit. So he built his reputation on being the so-called Prince of Puke. And Pink Flamingos, which is, you know, maybe his most famous movie, isn't really my favorite of his films because it's a feature-length provocation. It's a feature-length series of transgressive and dirty acts. Whereas this one, which, I mean, I guess is also a feature-length series of transgressive acts in its own way, but I think it's one that better articulates his sensibility and his aesthetic and his philosophy. I first discovered John Waters when I was, I think, in maybe middle school or early high school, not necessarily through this movie, which I watched later, because he made some more PG-13 movies that I saw first, like Cry Baby and Hairspray and Serial Mom. But I discovered him, I think, largely through his writing. There was a book of his essays called Crackpot, The Obsessions of John Waters, essays that he wrote for various magazines. And I'd like to read from one of the essays, an article called Guilty Pleasures that was originally published in Film Comment in the early 1980s. And it begins, "Being a Catholic, guilt comes naturally, except mine is reversed. I blab on ad nauseum about how much I love films like Dr. Butcher, M.D. or My Friends Need Killing. But what really shames me is I'm also secretly a fan of what is unfortunately known as the art film." He goes on to describe a number of his favorite art movies, which include Interiors by Woody Allen, Brink of Life by Ingmar Bergman. This is what he has to say about Brink of Life. "In high school, I used to sneak to a local college for a complete retrospective of the films of Ingmar Bergman. Except for Scenes from a Marriage, I still love Bergman, even The Serpent's Egg."
I like Scenes from a Marriage.
I do too. "But Brink of Life is my personal favorite. Three pregnant women locked in a maternity ward, going through all sorts of agony over miscarriage, abortion, sexual frigidity, fear, unwanted children, and all other neuroses that seem to be to Sweden what tulips are to Holland. Revival houses almost never dig this one out of their vaults, and I wish they would. Come on, Ingmar. How about Brink of Life, too?" And he writes of the films of Marguerite Duras. "Miss Duras makes the kinds of films that could get you punched in the mouth for recommending them to even your closest friends. If there is such a thing as good avant-garde cinema, this is it. Even though I believe pretension is the ultimate sin, Marguerite Duras has taken pretension one level ahead of itself and turned it into style. She is the ultimate eccentric. Her films are maddeningly boring, but really quite beautiful. After seeing her work, I think I know what it must feel like to be hypnotized. Perhaps her most impossible opus to date is The Truck. The entire film consists of the director sitting in a nondescript room with Gerard Depardieu as they read the script of the film while every 10 minutes or so, the monotony is replaced by yet another monotonous shot of a blue truck, endlessly but serenely driving through the French countryside. If Warhol did it for the Empire State Building, why can't Marguerite Duras do it for French trucks? All I know is that on my first trip to Cannes, in the cab from the Nice airport, I saw Marguerite Duras' trucks 100 times on the highway and felt hypnotized all over again." Writing like that really lit up my imagination when I was in grade 9 or so, because I think he, more than anyone else, you know, I didn't read Susan Sontag's Notes on Camp until a lot later, and he, more than anyone else, suggested to me that there was a cultural sensibility or an approach towards culture that went beyond a strict dichotomy of good or bad, or went beyond so bad it's good. Susan Sontag's famous definition of camp, which is that it's failed seriousness, or later on when John Waters did an appearance on The Simpsons, his character said that camp was the tragically ludicrous or the ludicrously tragic. I mean, that was a sensibility that really excited me and suggested there were whole other ways of viewing the world, also whole other cultural phenomena that might be worth studying. And I'm sure we'll get into this a little bit more too, but he was somebody who also seems to exist at the exact intersection of high and low, melding all sorts of sensibilities from all sorts of places. If I can ask you a question, one reason why I chose Female Trouble, partly I think it's because it's John Waters' best movie, or at least his most representative film, but I also think it might lead to some productive friction between the two of us, because, you know, I think it's obviously a funny movie, but I wasn't sure if it's a movie that you would necessarily gravitate towards, or that sort of its aesthetic is one that you love. Is that a fair question to ask?
I mean, it's tough, because I, on a kind of an intellectual level, I very much enjoy what it's doing, but I won't lie that I didn't find, I mean, that's actually, I've seen it before. And I mean, I won't lie that I, I don't find it a hugely pleasant sit. I mean, it is pretty gross, but I mean, I respect the way that it's gross and how it kind of like leans into that. I like what it's doing with, there's something almost kind of postmodern about it, like the way that it, you know, it's told in these kind of little vignettes where Divine is at different stages of her life. And then it's like each one almost seems like it's modeled on like a different kind of like, you know, at one point it's like a kind of family melodrama, you know, at another point it's more of a like cabaret kind of thing. Like it's just, it's all over the place and it seems to be drawing on like lots of different things that I guess John Waters liked and wanted to queer, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I respect that, but I mean, naturally, you're right. I mean, I don't think this is an aesthetic that I would exactly gravitate towards.
Well, in terms of his web of influences, I think one of the reasons why Waters has meant so much to me over the years is because he acts as a kind of doorway to a lot of other things. I'll get back to that in a sec, but I think I'll just briefly summarize the plot of the film, which is both very busy but also very simple. Divine plays Dawn Davenport, and we follow her from her high school years to her eventual death at the electric chair. In high school, she has a tragic falling out with her family on Christmas morning after their failure to get her cha-cha heels for Christmas. She becomes impregnated by a local man, also played by Divine, and gives birth to a child. For the next decade or so, she raises the child through a combination of menial work and sex work before eventually marrying a hairdresser named Gator, who's one of my favorite characters in the film. And in fact, you know, Gator, you know, one of the things that's great about this movie is so many of the actors are non-professional actors. And
get out of here.
Yeah. I don't know who this guy who plays Gator is, but there's a moment where he says, "I'm going to go to Detroit to find happiness in the auto industry." But he says it in this Baltimore accent where he says, "I'm going to go find happiness in Detroit in the auto industry." You know, as if he learned it phonetically. But soon she falls in with these seedy but glamorous types who represent an almost Charles Manson-ish cult who subscribe to the philosophy that crime equals beauty.
Yeah, yeah. To me, the one of the lines one of them says summed up the entire aesthetic of the movie and John Waters' entire project. One of them says to Divine, "The worse the crime gets, the more ravishing one becomes."
And yeah, that does describe the whole aesthetic, doesn't it? Because the movie is an assaultive viewing experience. It feels like entering a bizarro world where everything that is tacky is glamorous. Everything that is bad is good and vice versa. There's a wonderful scene early on where Edith Massey, who plays Gator's mother. Edith Massey was a thrift store owner in Baltimore who became a kind of underground sensation through these movies. She's very sad that her son is a heterosexual.
Right, right. And she says, "If people are smart, they're queer. And if they're dumb, they're straight."
"Oh, honey, I'd be so happy if you turned Nally."
"No way. I'm straight. I mean, I like a lot of queers, but I don't think they're equipment, you know? I like women."
"But you could change. Queers are just better. I'd be so proud if you was a fag and had a nice beautician boyfriend. I'd never have to worry."
"There ain't nothing to worry about."
"I worry that you work in an office, have children, celebrate wedding anniversaries. The world of heterosexual is a sick and boring life."
Yeah, and there's an essay on the film that points out, just reading from it here, "Even in our enlightened 21st century, these lines remain the most overt expression of gay militancy that American cinema has ever produced. In theaters, Aunt Ida's lament still elicits howls of approval from the audience."
It's funny, when I was a teenager, I think there was a lot that I felt kinship in. You know, I grew up pretty bourgeois, you know, a comfortable upper middle class childhood, which is also the way he grew up. But also, you know, in a gentle sort of way, wanting avenues of escape, you know, wanting avenues of exploration.
Is this your John Waters gave me the courage to be weird moment?
You see, the thing is, I'm trying not to say that because, like, if you say that, like, you sound like, oh, I'm a Tim Burton character, you know, like, I'm a little white kid, a little privileged white boy who just wanted to break free. But also be a little privileged white boy, you know? But the queer side of John Waters didn't even really occur to me at that age. And I feel like it sort of clicked into focus when I was reading Susan Sontag or reading a little bit more about camp, you know, as an older teenager. before Stonewall, before there was such a thing as a queer cinema, queer people often used to watch old Hollywood movies and they would sort of create queer movies out of them. The Wizard of Oz, for example, is considered a queer classic because you can create a story where there's boring old Kansas, but then there's this other land over the rainbow where everybody, all those boring farmhands, can be their true selves. And, you know, you can have a sissy lion and he can be his true self.
That actually, I mean, it sounds incredibly like liberating. I didn't know that about The Wizard of Oz, but I really like that.
And there are many Hollywood actresses like Betty Davis or especially Judy Garland who got appropriated as queer icons in this way. Partly it was because they were so starved for representation that they didn't have anything other than this. You know, they just had to appropriate mainstream culture. But Female Trouble is kind of like a post-Susan Sontag Stonewall version of this, where Divine is basically playing like Betty Davis. She's in an MGM melodrama, but like everybody's actually allowed to be queer now. Anyway, that didn't necessarily occur to me when I was in high school.
Well, I mean, forgive me, but what other way of watching this is there?
I mean, I knew that he was queer, but I think it goes back a little bit to the whole web of influences that have informed him and the way that he's a doorway to so many things. In this movie, I think you can see the influence of Rainer Werner Fassbinder, especially a movie like The Bitter Tears of Petra von Kant. I know he has cited Pasolini as a great influence on him. You can see the influence of Andy Warhol, the way that he would make superstars out of his weird friends, his weird non-actor friends. And he called his production company Dreamland Studios, basically an homage to Warhol's superstars. Like, this is my factory. And he also took a lot of inspiration from a couple of experimental filmmakers named George and Mike Kuchar, who made these garish-looking, Hollywood-inspired movies, basically in their bedrooms with a lot of camp. But then on the lower side of the spectrum, he took a lot of inspiration in all of these exploitation filmmakers, real carnival barker types. In particular, there was a guy named William Castle, who was sort of the poor man's Hitchcock. His big thing was all of his movies had a gimmick. He had a movie called The Tingler, where as part of the ad campaign, theater owners were asked to wire their seats with these little joy buzzers. And the tingler was something that like gets loose and it gets inside your spine and it zaps you. And there's a point in the movie The Tingler where the whole theater goes black and you hear Vincent Price's voice and he says, "Attention, the tingler is loose in this theater. The only way to survive is to scream. Scream for your lives." And then if you were in one of the lucky seats that had a joy buzzer in it, you would get the tingler. John Waters later made a film called Polyester that was presented in Odorama, where he had a card that had scratch and sniff on it. Like if the number one comes up on screen, you scratch number one on your card and you smell whatever the smell is. And the smells ranged from pleasant smells to, you know, the sorts of smells that you might expect to be in a John Waters movie. He also took a lot of inspiration in Russ Meyer, the exploitation filmmaker who made Faster Pussycat Kill Kill and Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, the one that Roger Ebert wrote. In particular, Faster Pussycat Kill Kill had this big, brassy, big-breasted lead character played by an actress named Tura Satana, who was always yelling all the time and always, like, dominating men. That's a movie that's, in some circles, been reclaimed as kind of a feminist exploitation movie, even though it's very leery, as you would expect it to be. So when I say that he lit up my imagination so much as a high schooler, I think it's having all of these different sensibilities melded into one. I once saw John Waters' portrait hung up in the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, which is incredible considering this movie. But it's also not so incredible because he's kind of like Elvis Presley in the way that he took all of these sensibilities and then put it into one guy who was able to be marketed kind of to the mainstream.
Although people did find movies like this very upsetting, right? I mean, there's, I don't think it's this film, but was it Pink Flamingos that Roger Ebert gave 0 stars to?
Yeah, Roger Ebert gave it 0 stars. And in that review, Ebert says, "Pink Flamingos appeals to that part of our psyches in which we are horny teenagers at the county fair with fresh dollar bills in our pockets and a desire to see the geek show with a bunch of buddies so that we can brag about it on Monday." He writes, John Waters is a charming man whose later films, such as Polyester and Hairspray, take advantage of his bemused take on pop culture. His early films, made on infinitesimal budgets and starring his friends, used shock as a way to attract audiences, and that is understandable. He jump-started his career, and in the movie business, you do what you gotta do. And I mean, he's not wrong. He's not wrong that Waters used shock to jumpstart his career. But you can see that Ebert is blind or not receptive to the anger, this anger at the normative institutions of society. Like, it's not just a provocation. There's an actual, like, project at work here. There's, it sounds crazy to say, but there's almost like a utopian vision in these films, even though they're full of, like, atrocities and horrific crimes and this and that.
Take a good look at me, because I'm going to be on the front of every newspaper in this country tomorrow. You're looking at crime personified, and don't you forget it!
I do think I interrupted you before you'd finished summarizing the plot, because I don't think we've told people how it ends, which I think is fair to do, since I think most people probably aren't going to watch it, or if they do, they might not watch it all the way through. By the way, I'm not saying this to trash the film at all. I think it's an incredible document, and I think everything Will's saying about the aesthetic project it represents is correct. I just think, like I said before, you should know what you're getting into before you you sit down with this one.
Well, Dawn Davenport and her daughter, Taffy, who's, you know, probably about 12 years old, but is played by Mink Stole, an actress in her 20s, they have a final falling out that leads to Taffy's death. Gator's mother is put in a cage and her hand is cut off and she's given a hook for a hand.
And she's put in a cage because she's attacked Dawn with acid and disfigured her face.
But in keeping with the whole philosophy of the film, Dawn is able to take her horrifically scarred face and turn it into something beautiful and glamorous through sheer force of personality. There's a hilarious scene in the film where Dawn, you know, with her scarred face and with her horrific outfit, just walks down the street of Baltimore, or, you know, not even walks down the street, but like dances down the street of Baltimore, just while, you know, obviously just documentary footage of the real Divine walking down Baltimore with various like awestruck passersby just kind of looking at him strangely. I'm calling him him because Divine always identified as a man. The film is somewhat prescient in the way that it anticipates the true crime boom. Dawn turns herself into a media superstar, staging this vaudeville act where she does trampoline acts and then says, "Who in the audience wants to die for art?" And she kills someone in the audience, is then put on trial, and then eventually put to the electric chair.
Something she's very happy about.
Yeah, this is her Oscar acceptance moment. This is, I think she says, the highest honor that someone in my profession can receive. And the movie ends, and I really think that this is an unspoilable movie, by the way, because it's really in the telling more than in the story being told.
Nothing that we could say about the plot. We could describe it shot by shot, unless you're watching it, you haven't experienced it.
But it ends with Dawn Davenport thanking all of her fans, reaching the absolute zenith of Divine's performance, and then having the life shocked out of her in the electric chair as the credits roll. I'll tell you something else about John Waters. I recently watched his last film, or his most recent film, which came out in 2004. It was called A Dirty Shame. And it was one of his more mainstream films. He eventually graduated to making Hollywood and or Hollywood adjacent movies. And A Dirty Shame is a movie about sex addicts. It's a comedy about people who like get bonked on the head, you know, normal Baltimore suburban people who get bonked on the head, and that turns them into sex addicts. And the thesis of the movie is that sexual promiscuity is actually good and a liberating force. And the movie came out kind of in the American Pie scary movie era. And it was very much pitched that way. It was pitched as being like, okay, this is John Waters making a gross out comedy. And it actually got an NC-17 rating, which none of those movies did. NC-17 is the rating above R. And it's funny when you watch the movie because there's no actual explicit sex in it. It's a very goofy movie. It's nowhere near as transgressive as Female Trouble is. It's quite a mainstream film. But as recently as 2004, there was still something about his cultural sensibility that I guess was difficult for an institution such as the Motion Picture Association of America to accept, because it was the only one of those movies from that gross-out comedy boom, I think, that was sex-positive. It was a movie that positioned all forms of sex, gay, straight, polyamorous, strange fetishes, what have you, as being equal and as being all good. all the gross out comedies of that time are like 50% gay panic jokes.
I mean, it seems like John Waters has managed to remain pretty cutting edge. But in spite of all this, you know, as we were talking about earlier, you know, off mic, like he's kind of has met the same fate as like so many other artists of every kind, which is that he is just sort of like a rich lib, right? I mean, he's like, he was like, he endorsed Hillary Clinton in 2016.
Yeah, he did. He was for Hillary. I mean, whenever he's, I think he liked Pete Buttigieg. He said something nice about Pete Buttigieg in an interview last time.
Unbelievable.
And like, I actually don't want to beat up on John Waters about this because I think he's done enough for us. I think, you know, he is one of my favorite artists and always will be one of my favorite artists. And like, I still think he's funny. I still think he has a lot of things to say, but A Dirty Shame is a movie that if it came out now, like culture has caught up with A Dirty Shame, you know?
Right.
Now everything is sex positive. It wasn't quite the same in 2004, but now I think the particular battles that he was fighting, like he's won a lot of them. You know what I mean? At least in a mainstream North American context. Some listeners might object to that, but that's how it seems to me. And I think John Waters' place in society, like the fact that he is like a beloved grandfather who is welcome everywhere.
That's kind of what I was going to say next. I mean, I feel like that's a role that he's embraced, but it is a sort of funny parallel. You know, you're saying like he's my Tony Benn. I mean, it's like exactly what happened with Tony Benn. Like this guy that was making this like radical queer cinema in the 70s that mainstream film critics were so upset by. Ebert was giving, you know, Pink Flamingos 0 stars. It's like, yeah, he's now just like a national treasure. And every time he comes up, you hear about like how he, you know, oh yeah, in Baltimore, he just hangs out at bars and talks to people. And he's just, you know.
Yeah. And I love that about him. On some level, I love that he's a national treasure. And I mean, you can't necessarily expect everyone in their 70s to, you know, still be bad. I mean, the reason why he doesn't make movies anymore is because he can't get the budgets for the kind of movies he wants to make. He could make a movie for $500,000 or $1 million if he wants to. But as he said in interviews, look, I own 3 homes. I'm not going to make a movie for $1 million. And I get it, but I think there's also something just a little bit sad about that, you know?
Yeah.
And like a difference between him and Tony Benn, I think. One of many differences between him and Tony Benn, actually. They don't exactly live parallel lives. But a difference is that Waters has fully embraced, been fully comfortable, you know, like he endorsed D-Ray for mayor of Baltimore, and D-Ray accepted his endorsement. John Waters can go anywhere in the world that he wants and be welcomed. And I think somebody like Tony Benn, from what you were saying to me, he bristled against his elder statesman status a little bit.
He hated it. I mean, he did things that made life very difficult for his son, who is both a Labour MP and also is like a new Labour loyalist. So yeah, no, he really did bristle against that.
Were Tony Benn and his son, like, did they have a falling out?
No, they remain pretty close. But like Hillary Benn, his pretty shitty politically, like, son, his like working line was like, I'm a Benn, but I'm not a Bennite. But yeah, no, so he sucks. He was like a big anti-Corbyn guy.
I'll tell you who never liked John Waters was my dad. Always bristled at him whenever he was on TV. I think my dad and my mom went to see Polyester when they were on a date and they didn't like it. And, you know, it's funny. When I was a teenager, John Waters was already like well on his way to being a national treasure. Like Hairspray had become a Broadway musical at that point. Even when I was a teenager, he wasn't all that transgressive. But it's helpful when you're a teenager, like a bourgeois teenager living in the suburbs, to have like cultural icons who feel like semi-rebellious, even when they're not rebellious, really. Like, it's fun to have a guy that you like who your dad doesn't like.
I don't know, though. I mean, were you watching these early ones? Because I would say this is pretty rebellious even today. I mean,
well, actually, that is true.
And ironically, a lot of like, I think a film like this would offend not only the sensibilities of kind of the, you know, the moralist right, but also, you know, certain other constituencies that are not on the right as well, if it came out today.
I know that Waters has said that he was always a liberal, but he made movies to offend liberals. Which, you know, when you say that now, it sounds like Trey Parker and Matt Stone or that sort of thing. One of the reasons why he's been able to become an elder statesman is that a lot of people found themselves represented in John Waters' films. And I think the fact that they weren't politically correct, you know, John Waters always seems to be on the side of good, and that allows him to be politically incorrect. And so people watching his movies, they feel like these movies are sort of like safe spaces to have bad thoughts. Does that make sense?
Yeah, this essay I was reading on the film kind of concludes that way. It says, yet in Female Trouble, the glorification of crime and evil is unmistakably allegorical, a way for us to indulge in extreme antisocial sentiments without anyone really getting hurt. You're looking at crime personified, Divine cries as Dawn, just before she shoots into her own audience wearing a mohawk-like hairdo that predicts punk. In the upheavals of its boundary-pushing comedy, Female Trouble seems to slyly ask for a revaluation of all values, collapsing any distinction between high and low, good taste and bad, beauty and ugliness. These are concerns that run through Waters' now vast oeuvre of film, writing, visual art, and other creations, but it is in Female Trouble that his ideas are most fully delineated and most thoroughly embodied by his greatest muse.
I framed Leslie Bacon! I called the heroin hotline on Abby Hoffman! I bought the gun that Bremer used to shoot Wallace! I had an affair with Juan Corona! I blew Richard Spitz! And I'm so fucking beautiful I can't stand it myself!
Anyway, I know Luke is telling everyone to proceed with caution. I say that everybody should see the movie, and if possible, they should show it to the youngest person that they know to set them on the right path for future.
I'm glad we discussed this, because, you know, it's been a running gag throughout the episode on my part that, like, you know, we're probing the dark recesses of Will Sloan's brain. But I do think this is something like this is a very important part of your overall sensibility and your outlook on cinema and also on plenty of other things. Like, I feel like there's a stereotype of the film bro, the art house guy that a lot of people might superficially apply to someone like you. Like, oh yeah, Will Sloan, that's the guy. He probably owns the Fellini box set. He's probably really into, like, you know, Jodorowsky and whatever. And it's like, you do look like those things. You appreciate the high, but you also appreciate the low. And more importantly, you actually like collapsing them. Like, you have an interest in trash and, like, bargain basement stuff, which extends, I mean, people have probably picked up on that in your, you know, long-running interest in things like Al Goldstein and Screw magazine. Like, the vulgar and the base are things that have always informed your own taste. Like, they're things that you actually like. You know, actually, I remember back when we first started hanging out, I sometimes had trouble understanding, like, in what sense you were appreciating certain things. Like, does Will actually like this? And if he does, like, in what sense? And I remember asking you once, like, I can't remember what bad movie you were watching, but I was saying, like, so do you actually like this, or do you like it ironically? And you kind of, like, mused for a second, and you were like, you know, I don't really know. I think in the sort of 10 years or so since whatever that viewing was transpired, you've clarified your thoughts on a lot of this kind of stuff, and I think I understand your tastes and sensibilities much better myself.
Well, one thing Female Trouble does is create a moral and aesthetic universe where everything ugly is beautiful. And I think that's a very useful pair of They Live glasses to have throughout your life.
Perhaps this is stretching the, conceptual boundaries of our show too much, but I actually see a parallel in how I feel like certain people might pass judgment about, like, certain people might superficially scan, like, your Twitter timeline or something and think, like, oh yeah, this is one of those annoying guys that likes art films. And that's, like, something that a lot of people associate with a kind of pretension. And obviously, for the reasons I said, they would be wrong about that, at least in your case. I actually feel like I, in my own life, experience a version of this sometimes, because periodically, I will be talking to someone about, you know, something to do with politics. I'll be talking about, like, how I see the world and, like, how sort of big abstract things, like how I'd like the world to look. And I'll be met, you know, this happened in many different ways, many, many times over the years. And I'll get a version of a response that's like, well, like, this is how you think because, like, you know, you studied political science and because you think about this stuff all the time. But this is, like, I mean, the implication, it's too difficult to paraphrase all the different ways that this has been said to me, all the different versions of this I've heard. But, you know, the implication is always, like, sort of parallel to what I think some people might erroneously ascribe to you, is that, like, if you have a political identity like mine, you only are thinking in these kind of, like, macro abstract philosophical terms, and you're not really thinking about on the ground stuff, the low and the high low art distinction that is so often made. And, you know, I really, really hate that. In fact, there's few things that bug me more than that, because it's like, I've done the grittiest, like, political work you could possibly imagine, including running for office, by the way, which is, like, literally the least glamorous thing you could possibly do, like, going to retirement homes and, like, you know, talking to bored seniors, you know, who aren't really that interested in who you are and are just, like, happy someone's talking to them about anything, knocking on doors in a neighborhood and being shouted at by people who are mad about something Bob Ray did in 1993, whatever. I mean, or the more common experience, which is just being completely ignored because people don't know there's an election going on or whatever, right? I've done all that stuff. I've done the grittiest, like, I've done constituency work that's not even particularly political. I mean, it's like, I do actually think about all of that stuff. And I don't want to exaggerate this, but I have actually enjoyed doing a lot of that stuff in, you know, various ways at various times. So I don't know, perhaps I'm inadvertently giving, you know, we promised some insight into your psyche, and perhaps I'm giving too much insight into mine, but this is something that's always bugged me about the way certain people have responded to my opinions when we're talking about politics, particularly when we're talking about, for want of a better word, like the vision stuff.
Well, I think we've both bared maybe a little bit too much of our psyches today. And, you know, what can I say? I don't want to go to therapy when it's on Zoom. So instead, I have the Michael and Us podcast.
Boom, 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 boom. D-I-G means look. D-I-G means stare. D-I-G means see. D-I-G means glare. D-I-G means...
Well, I wanted to ask you if the phrase... I think I know the answer, but are you familiar with the Amari French debate at all? Have you heard this phrase?
I have not, I'm sorry to say.
Okay, so this is really fascinating. I hope, by the way, perhaps a real head can tell us if, in fact, I have brought this up on the show before and I've forgotten, and also, and then, you know, by extension, Will wasn't listening closely enough and has forgotten as well. But I was thinking about this recently. This was the big debate in American conservatism. And by that, I don't mean, like, among people who vote Republican. I mean, like, the conservative intellectuals, the conservative movement. I can't remember who it was called this a full employment program for right-wing pundits, because that's what it became. And, you know, there's a few elements to this. And, you know, basically, the two poles of the debate are this guy, David French, who's sort of a, you know, classical liberal, sort of libertarian in some ways, and this guy, Sohab Amari, who is a major figure in the Catholic right and is the opinion editor for the New York Post. So, I mean, basically, Amari was very upset by the phenomenon of drag queen story hour, which, you can imagine, was some kind of, you know, event, I believe, in a San Francisco public library. This might have been a huge thing on Twitter for 2 days, but within kind of American conservatism, where it's like, quote unquote, intellectual wing, this was such a big deal, this debate. So Amari basically said, you know, conservatives need to be doing more about stuff like this. This is a problem. Like, we object to this on moral grounds. So David French basically countered by, this is quoting from him here, he says, "We have a nation of 320 million people. Events like Drag Queen Story Hour are, quote, choices people make in a free nation." He called Amari's attitude free speech for me, but not for thee, and said that he would set a precedent that could be easily used to shut down conservative viewpoints as well. Then, you know, French went on and he argued, like, the real problem is that, you know, millions of Americans don't have a relationship to Christ. Tens of millions of even Christian American men are addicted to porn, yada, yada, yada. So the two poles of this debate are very interesting. Like, you have the arch reactionary religious right position, which is basically just like, this is bad, so we need to ban it. We have to fight this. And then you have the, like, classical liberal trying to be sort of somewhat philosophically consistent position where, you know, David French is basically saying, like, look, we live in a pluralist society. You have to, you know, you have to accept different viewpoints. But then he is, like, himself basically shares a kind of socially conservative, you know, worldview. And he's echoing a lot of the critiques that someone like Sohab Amari might have about, you know, American society. Like, it's become, you know, like, decadent and people are watching porn and there's, like, a decline of religion, all this kind of stuff. Sohab Amari, and I can't remember what the timeline is here, if this precedes or came after the debate I just talked about, but Sohab Amari basically wrote this thing called Against David Frenchism. And, you know, David French is a guy who his position on stuff like this is that you can fight the culture war, and sometimes you're going to win some and sometimes you're going to lose some. But it's a pluralist society, and you kind of just have to, like, use the constitutional mechanisms that are available. And, you know, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. So Obamari's rejoinder to this is basically like, you can't fight the culture war because it's like the game is rigged. All somebody like David French is doing, according to Sohab Amari, is like surrendering to the forces of like secular liberalism, surrendering to postmodernity. Now, there are so many different sides to this debate. And as I said, every single, you know, right wing writer, like every person that works at like National Review, Federalist, whatever, they all got in on this. You know, Reason got in on it. Some places argued that the debate was kind of fake, that, you know, both of these people are critical of like political liberalism anyway. Neither of them actually favors a pluralist society in terms of their own private moral views. So this is a kind of internecine right-wing debate that doesn't really matter. I'm not really sure where I stand on all this. The only reason I was thinking about it, apart from just the fact that I find like intra-conservative debates inherently interesting, is I was thinking about the fact that a film like Female Trouble, I was thinking about what would happen if like someone like Sohab Amari or David French for that matter were made to watch it, and how basically to them stuff like this is like, this is literally the downfall of society. Okay, imagine Jerry Falwell watching this, and I will just say that if you sample any part of the film and you know, find yourself bothered or disgusted by it, assemble in your mind's eye an image of Sohab Amari having to sit through a screening of the film, and I think you're gonna feel a lot better about what it's doing.
You know, it's funny when you read those perspectives, obviously, like, I find myself more sympathetic to the David French one if I have to pick a side, but that's only because obviously I don't want the event or the film or what have you to be banned because I'm sympathetic to it. If you actually think that this thing literally is the downfall of society, then wouldn't you want it banned? Shouldn't it be the law for it to be banned if it is literally actually harmful to society?
Well, I mean, this is why I don't think something like David French's classical liberalism really makes any sense. I don't see how you could, like, the type of liberal perspective that he has, the sort of constitutional liberal perspective, is premised on the idea that there's a public morality and there's a private morality. Public morality would be embodied by something like the United States Constitution, right? It's a set of rules. It's a sort of legal architecture that governs everything. And you can contest, you know, within the structures that it gives you, you can contest things. You can even contest on the basis of your own private morality. Like, I'm offended by X, Y, and Z. I think X, Y, and Z is bad. I want to defeat it. But you might lose because it's a pluralist society, whatever. So, and then there's this private morality, right? But then when it comes to private morality, like, you have somebody like French, who is himself also a social conservative, at least maybe not in the same sense that Sohab Amari is, but, you know, he's a social conservative in that, you know, he's rattling off about porn, and it's like, oh, there's been a decline of, not enough people believe in the teachings of Jesus Christ, and this is leading to, like, social decline of, you know, frayed social cohesion, you know, yada, yada, yada. I don't know how that position can really be sustained, because, like, if you accept, as you said, I mean, if you genuinely, like, I don't believe that you can actually privatize morality. Morality is by definition universal. If you believe a moral axiom to be true, it doesn't mean that you believe it's true for yourself, but not for other people.
I think fossil fuels are harmful to society. I think we should be moving away from them. I would love to get to the point where fossil fuels are illegal. At some point, that's not a matter of opinion, is it? And if you are the sort of person who thinks that a movie like Female Trouble is literally harmful to society, is tangibly harmful to society, much like how fossil fuels are tangibly harmful to society, wouldn't it stand to reason that you would want it banned?
Right. And obviously, I hope we don't need to say that, you know, these two things are not equivalent. Obviously, the entire yes. point we're making here is that, like, you can't, a la David French, like, sever private morality from something. So in its, like, awful, reactionary, twisted way, the, like, pro-theocracy position that Sohab Amari took in this debate, like, it is more philosophically consistent than the one that David French is taking.
Wow. Now watch this drive.
Someone who does not know irony, for example, I do understand humor, but I take things literal and whatever other references that might be there doesn't occur to me. So for me, a chair is a chair, and I do not reference to other possibilities. What could the chair refer to? in a very simple term, how straightforward and simple I see. For me, a man is a man. I cannot distinguish a gay man from a straight man. I just cannot distinguish, unless the man comes in drag and is so obviously gay, then I would notice. I would notice. And I saw a filmmaker whom I know since 35 years, John Waters. John Waters, just 2 weeks ago or so, John Waters. And I turned to my wife. We talked backstage because we were both speaking at an event for the founder of New Line Cinema, who is a friend of both of us. After 35 years of knowing John Waters, I turned to my wife and I said to her, I have the feeling this man is gay. which is in a way wonderful, because I took him as John Waters, and I love the man. I love him dearly, and he's the boldest of the bold of filmmakers. I wish I had the guts of this man. And he's very, very dear to my heart. But for me, this is a man. Yes, a man is a man.